Hi, I'm Patrick Bocard. You are listening to Talking Earth. This is KBO Portland, 90.7 in your FM dial, and I'm here in the studio with four poets who read often in Astoria. Florence Sage, are you there?
Hello, I'm here.
She has a 2014 poetry collection, Nonetheless, Poems from the Gray Area. Please correct me if I mess anything up. She was the poetry editor for Hipfish. Unfortunately, that's no longer the case, but hopefully we can change it on the basis of this show. John Simonello.
Hello.
His work has appeared in Sun Magazine, Rain, Mentor, Sulai Review, and Analog, and amazingly, it's science fiction poetry in Analog. That's pretty awesome in my book. And his haiku chapbook is titled Shrine Above High Tide. The next poet is Jim Dott. Jim Dott is the author. Okay, wait. Jim, are you there?
Yes, I'm here. Hi.
I'm going a little too fast. Jim Dott is the author of A Glossary of Memory, an imagined memoir in poetry. He also has a program currently on K-Moon. Is that correct?
That's correct, yes.
So it's still going on.
Yeah, bedtime stories for kids.
And hopefully I will ask you about the imagined memoir in poetry that is very similar to something another poet, a writer from here, is done recently. And then the last poet on our program is Robert Michael Pyle. His 20 books include Wintergreen and The Tangled Bank. A Guggenheim Fellow, he has received the John Burroughs Medal and several other writing awards. Pyle's poems have appeared in magazines including North American Review and in a chapbook, Letting the Flies Out. Evolution of the Genus Iris was his first full-length book of poems. Chinook and Chanterelle is his second collection from Lost Horse Press. Are you there, Bob?
Hi, Patrick. It's nice to be here.
That's awesome that you're here. And I have one more bio for someone who unfortunately is not here. Rick Verana was a mainstay in the Northwest poetry scene since the 1980s when he was running, he was a founder of the long-running Red Sky Poetry Theater in Seattle. For a decade, he was a frequent reader at poetry events in Portland, both at an open mic and as a featured reader. He actually was in the movie I co-wrote with my friend Ceylon Anderson, The Warriors. He was a member of the Third Eye group. He had he kind of accosted us on Hawthorne. I had a sarcastic line I said to him that I won't repeat on air. Verana's poetry is featured in The Broken Word 2, the Alberta Street Anthology, and Blown Out, Portland's Indies Poets. Contributor online Portland zines like Work and Elhui Gadugi, which I've never heard of. Wow. He also authored three chapbooks of poetry, including the poem cycle Postales desde Costa Rica and Semi-Ambivalent Middle-Aged Male Lament Number 25, which is a great book if you can find it. And I think we're going to Florence and John and Jim, the three of you are going to read a poem by Rick's.
Bob,
okay.
Not John, but... Yeah, this is a poem called The Ship Report, which was published in Rain Magazine. It's a publication of Clatsop Community College. And this volume was dedicated to the memory of Rick. And he's talking about a program on KMUN, which airs every day. It tells about the ships coming in, going on the Columbia River.
I think this was his final published poem, wasn't it, John?
Yes, I believe so. Someone bothers to take note and report.
Morning, before the sun, I take the air.
From the left, on the river, moves the ship.
She broadcasts daily on coastal radio.
First broken shards of sunlight, a color.
Bulk freighter enters port under the bridge.
Today, she says, we have six ships in port.
Color more blue than red, cyan light.
I watch the pilot ship's human transfer.
And 10 coming in and 8 going out.
Which streams under clouds but above the East Hills.
I watch the pilot ship return to port.
She relates estimated times of passage.
In this sideways light, all is an oil painting.
Navigation was a priority of the nascent republic.
Going on, she lists their cargoes and origins.
The light is special at the edge of the continent.
Promoting trade or defense, depending on the hour.
Tells us what cargo awaits at what upriver port.
The blue-gray-green continental edge.
Interior nation craves entering shipments.
She concludes with the marine weather forecast.
Forecast today again of more gray, blue, green.
Bulk freighter sits days in the anchorage, awaiting berth upriver.
And a feature piece on a maritime topic.
What colors are injected by the next otherworldly ship?
Without, since 9/11 paranoia, customs clearance.
She'll report again this news tomorrow.
The river will wake to another color, another light.
Like prisoners, foreign sailors, now forbidden shore leave.
So he wrote that for three or four voices.
Well, I think he wrote for three.
Yeah, and it's the wonderful thing about it is each of the voices can be read as a separate poem.
And I don't know. I was just thinking of the. I'm still thinking that a story is. I think of a Cape Disappointment is what I'm thinking of, just because of the ships coming in, how often they're in trouble.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. They're right across the river.
Yeah. So, did you want to, Florence? Did you want to talk about the reading series that Rick was involved in Astoria?
Yeah, Rick had been in Astoria maybe 6 months or so, and finally said, I've got to start a poetry mic here. I'm used to having poetry mics. And we used to have one years ago at the River Theater, and actually Jim Dodd here and I were the hosts of that for several years. But it had been 15 years, no, not quite, 12 years since we'd done that. And Rick put together a plan to run a monthly poetry open mic, totally open mic, no guests. And we started that at the Port of Call Tavern in Astoria. And that ran for a little over a year when suddenly he died. And so we waited a while, and I think it was in May we had a memorial, a dedicated reading.
Yes.
Yeah, just poems that we all brought poems that we thought Rick would like to hear.
Kind of a poetical wake.
Yeah, poetic wake. Yeah. And then we restarted the mic in a different place this time at Winecraft, which is a wine bar right on the river. And we've named it Rick's Poetry Mic. Henceforth shall be known. Okay, Rick's Poetry Mic. And so it's a monthly mic in the same format that he started.
Yeah, Rick is very much missed by many there, but we feel that the series will carry on his spirit and keep him in our midst.
And his name.
And his name.
Mm-hmm. That's great. I mean, well, first off, I think Astoria is too large a town to not have an open mic.
Right.
Were there no feature series as well, or was it just...
Just ad hoc. There were Kala at Hipfish. There's a performance space called Kala, had readings ad hoc, you know, when somebody launched a new book or something, yeah, but not
and
nothing
still
regular.
Does,
and still does.
Does,
excuse yeah, me, yeah.
But it's not like a regular occurrence.
Right.
No, it's not regular.
It never
yeah,
was meant yeah. to be.
No, the regular long-running series that was at the River Theater that Florence and Jim ran for a long time, and a lot of the poets from the area and from outside read in that over the years, so that was missed.
Mm-hmm. And yeah. That would, I drove through Astoria recently, and it's too large a town to not have something like that going on.
Should mention, too, that, of course, Astoria hosts the world-renowned Fisher Poets Festival.
Gathering.
I'm sorry, I always say the wrong word. Fisher Poets Gathering, that Florence was one of the major founders of, still involved in. Mm-hmm. And this year there were 93 poets on six venues, six
poets
stages.
And musicians, yes.
Quite a remarkable thing that's come about.
We've completed 18 events and still going.
Mm-hmm. Oh,
it's at the end of February every year.
Okay, so
in various pubs downtown.
So my fears need to be put away.
There's a lot of good poetry.
It's happening, but more could happen.
But they're all commercial fishermen, so it's a different different scene.
They're still writing poetry, though.
And they come from Alaska, like 5 or 6 different states.
And it should be mentioned, too, Patrick, that there's poetry up at the college, at Clatsop College, and the students have a poetry club as well.
Okay.
They have their own readings from time to time and gatherings. So, there's good poetry energy there.
And Clatsop Community College publishes Rain magazine once a year, which we were just reading from.
Oh. And we've all appeared in it.
And we've all appeared in it multiple times. Okay. Yeah. So, we all pitch in.
Do any of you want to read from, start reading your poetry? From Rain magazine or others? Or
sure.
Yeah. Take it away, Florence.
Everybody's looking at me,
yes.
So here we go.
Florence. First, Florence.
All right, I'll start off with this little one, After Image in Astoria. Tell me that was you I saw at 16th and Grand, or was I hallucinating, or who was it? Up the steep incline, rising from muck to fill to rock. You know as well as I do you'd never bother to climb. So why were you striding past the tilted pale Victorians, back to the wind off the swaying river, flying your improbable hair just at the corner of my eye where emotions have their way? That blurred dimension you never used to walk in, where I always seem to catch your quick sepia trace and turn to follow. Now that you're gone.
It's a lovely poem. Well, I'll follow with another poem from Astoria, really, and it's from the river. It's from the lower river and the whole river. And since two of us, John and I, live on the Washington side of the river, and two, Florence and Jim, live on the Oregon side of the river, this, I think, speaks to elements that we all know well, and that... KBOO listeners way up the river will know as well. It's called Chinook and Chanterelle. It's the title poem of my second book of poems. What gifts these are from river and woods, these coral ones, muscled strumpets plucked from the fisher's nets where the shrunken runs still shine. And these golden ones, fluted trumpets pinched from the forest floor where the second growth hemlocks still stand. Surely we are unworthy of such as these. Ah, but if enjoyment of succulent flesh is any mitigation, if the tongue's fierce possession of taste can be extenuation, if the way we chew and praise and slurp and swallow and say it, worship this fin and stipe, these silver scales and meaty caps, can sing the hard shimmer in the stream, can cry the soft glimmer on the mossy floor, can save us. If these gestures make any difference whatsoever, well, then maybe we deserve them after all.
Poetry in Astoria can make you hungry, huh?
Yeah, it can. Fortunately, lots of good restaurants to
Yes.
This is Jim. I'm going to read a poem called A Drink from the River's Mouth, which was written for a Columbia Riverkeepers fundraiser a number of years ago in Astoria. Dip a cup into Columbia's mouth. Taking a sip of this water, while not recommended, will not kill you. Traces mixed from all along the river's course, melt from Bugaboo Glacier near the headwaters, drops that spun the turbines at Grand Coulee, groundwater from along Hanford Reach, runoff from Horseheaven Hills, water that passed through 1,000 salmon gills, bathed their eggs in gravel rills, and washed the ghosts of fishers and fish at Celilo Falls, now silent, under flat water. Water that spent years in the blood of great-grandmother sturgeon was bound into the membrane of one of her million eggs, then returned to the river on hatching. A little pesticide, some oil, topsoil, and sewage, and finally a dash of brine brought in with the tide. Let's toast to the journey each molecule took from the source our salty mother to hear, to the sun and evaporation, to trade winds delivering vapor for clouds, to snow on the Cascades and rain in the Blues, to droplets of fog that cling to needle tips, then fall when Raven lands on the branch, gathering into rivulet, runnel, creek, joining and joining until they are the rivers, Kootenay, Canoe, Okanagan, Methow, Chelan, Wenatchee, Yakima, Crab, the long twisting snake, Walla Walla, Umatilla, John Day, Willow, Deschutes, both rocks, Klickitat, White Salmon, Hood, Sandy, Wind, Willamette, Washougal, Lewis, Kalama, Cowlitz, Klatskanai, Grays, Klatskanine, Lewis and Clark, Skipanon, who make their tributes to Columbia's flow. All these traces, these journeys are mixed now in this cup. Drink up.
Very good.
I love that ending.
John Simonello here. I'm going to read a poem that I read first at Rick's open mic. It's called Firsts, A Taste of Snow. One, first snow, first star, first cloud of breath hanging in a sky bigger than our differences and older than this barren landscape, asleep and dreaming in shades of green. I make noise with my feet to stay warm, and then it happens. The air tingles with the alchemy of water, a trick of elemental physics, one speck of dust with six lattices of crystals, frozen and falling with mathematical whimsy, all sparkle and refracted glory like a stained glass galaxy, and I stick out my tongue to taste a constellation of melting stars. Two, waiting for the first breath, the first twitch of life ascendant, and everyone in the room holds their breath. Midwives prep for respiratory distress. From the back of the room, a voice with more intention than fear says, breathe, little one, breathe. A prayer, a whispered chant of comfort, a debt one for another. And in the confusion, a half gasp awakens the trembling soul inside his tiny chest. Waiting outside, the fire tenders begin a welcoming song to this wet, bedazzled stranger, a heartbeat away from the threshold. Three. First try, first wobble, first tumble, and all is well back to the beginning in a fool's paradise, like chasing adventure on a summer afternoon, skinning knees by stirring up dust and trouble, or like going back to school to learn the history of firsts, from the conquests of Jerusalem to a walk on the moon, the vanity of crown, flag, and corporate cross, all less than the expansive breath of the first kiss, first love, first heartbreak. No different now, alone, waiting outside as winter illuminates the gray. In the air, I can almost taste the coming of the first snow.
Nice. That's so nice, John.
Nice, John.
Okay, I'll pick up again. You can't live in Astoria without a little bit of worry. This was written in. This was written in 1998. In a very stormy November, when everybody had just started to talk about the earthquake and the tsunami in serious tones. So this poem is a little over the top, but I figure so is the tsunami. It's called In the Path of the Tsunami. This wild November night, I sink into my feather bed and think about how we'll die, the three of us in this house. My boys riding the wind in dreams downstairs. One stub of candle to see me down to their bedroom. Those two I'd run down hell's backstairs of fire to find. Finished with the power lines, they're down. The wind toys with the house. Rowdies the roof and walls. Won't sleep. Past three on my clock and fretful child, it won't let me. Shifts my organs into commotion with relentless shakes of the bed, and surely the feathers are floating, small, imperceptible to my mind, but organs know, and they're nervous, like the watchful back of my brain that knows about dying tonight, the house lashed by wind and rain, reminded what's coming, what's to face. When the big one comes, it's got to come. The longest, hardest quake, 9-point release of tectonic plates, bedrock sound you've never heard, wires and candles out, gas line flames lick up the streets and they're on your stairs, and it lifts you off the bed trying to find your heart, more stark awake even than tonight, gravity replaced by air. No way your legs will carry you to reach those suns down there. Best every night, anoint their heads and kiss them sweet goodbye. You know it already, tight in your gut, and tonight it's on your mind how you're fooling yourself that when it slows down, you're just going to run. Because then the ocean rolls out its monster of a tongue right over all your bedrooms, coming far too fast and loud and strong and soon for you and yours. It's big and bad and bitter cold and has no fear. And there's nothing you can do but give in to it tonight.
Mm-hmm. Wow. This is what we live with.
Yeah.
This constant coming of carbon in its many ways, although we pushed that back. 20 years of fighting 3 proposed liquefied natural gas terminals in the Lower Columbia have come to a good end so far. But another thing we live with down there, Patrick, is the constant presence of changing factors in the river, and the fact that we try to make them change in certain ways and they change in other ways that we didn't have in mind. John Muir said, you can't touch just one thing. How did Garrett Hardin put it?
Jim? Can't only do one thing.
Can't only do one thing. And so this poem is called Unintended Consequences. This has also been written for a collaboration I've been working on with Chris Novoselic and Ray Prestigard of Music and Poetry. But it stands, I hope, on its own as a poem, too. It's written in iambs. It's an iambic poem. Unintended Consequences. To make the channel deep for ships, the Army Corps pumped out the sand from riverbed and stacked it up in spoil islands in midstream. And to the new hotels of sand came cormorants and terns to nest, and then they fed their chicks on salmon smolts. To save the lions of the sea, the Noah said they can't be shot, and so their numbers grew and grew, and all the docks are swaddled with their blubbered bulks, the airways clogged with barks and roars, and lions eat their fill of salmon up the gorge. So now the Army Corps is shooting birds and oiling nests, and bogus orca bellies up instead of scaring lions off, and one sea lion basks upon its floating wreck as others of its kind get shot beneath the dam. Everything we touch comes back to haunt the best-laid plans, as every timorous beast comes home to eat the hand that shoots it. People of the river towns look on and shake their heads and mutter, how in hell did those guys get it wrong again, and turn away and hawk and spit. And so I think of every double-crested cormorant that came and bred because we made the habitat, of every lion of the sea that fouls a dock or eats a fish because we gave it what it needs, and how we're going to take it back and give them both hot lead instead, and claim the fish and take the dock and make the fix, and then, guess what? We'll start the whole damn thing again to make the channel deep for ships.
This is from my book, A Glossary of Memory, which is 26 poems in alphabetical order. And each poem's got a little definition of the word, or in this case, a part of a word. It's from E-U-E-U hyphen. A combining form, from Latin, from the Greek, use, meaning good, well, pleasant, beneficial. Her father's constant striving for eudaimonia, good spirits, well-being, gotten, he professed, from an active, rational life, this,
despite his wife's death at his daughter's birth, his later battles with darker spirits. What others labeled fate, he scoffed off as chance. Fate's a facade the weak-minded hide behind. We have free will, and I choose to embrace it. The sharp, familiar scent of eucalyptus with its well-covered buds when the ship entered San Francisco Bay smelled again in its native home when they sailed to Australia. The leaves of a winged euonymus near her mother's grave that burned bright red each fall and always set him weeping when they went there on the anniversaries of her death. The arrhythmy of the open ocean swell, the deep euphony of foghorns, the sweeping beams and flashes of lighthouse lights on clearer nights, the euphoric calm she felt after storms at sea. He took the salty waters as his Eucharist. His eulogy, he had said, should be good years, sad years, now gone.
Mm-hmm. Very nice. Very nice, Jim. This next poem I'm going to read is called The Pencil. It's dedicated to Robert Cunningham, a gentleman with autism I used to work with many years ago. The Pencil for Robert Cunningham. From the warehouse floor, a conveyor belt fills with refuse. Empty soup cans, plastic containers reeking of sour milk, newspapers, half-melted candles, and busted radio speakers dumped from a huge green tote trucked in from suburban stations and spread for sorting by people like Robert, lost in his autistic freedom, talking to voices trapped inside shoeboxes, all the while listening to the angelic vibration like whispers telling him, it's a filthy job, but hey, someone's got to do it. So Robert ignores the rules he breaks when it's time to work. Lunch hour is better than payday, and he clocks in and out like a game show contestant, as if 100 punches on his time card wins the prize for the best crooked smile to charm the ladies in payroll. And every day he steals trash from the yard, a glass marble, a mahjong tile, a zipper, a pencil, a magazine. And he smuggles them out under his shirt back into circulation with his in-your-face special delivery, greasy beard and all, a quirky gift destined for a stranger in paradise. Like one summer afternoon, hot and sweaty, Robert snags an unmarked cassette tape from a banker's box as it falls into the hopper, where a platinum ram flattens half a ton of cardboard. And he is beside himself, Robert to the rescue, as he hands the Memorex to Rich Gordy, a blues man. You listen, he says. And two nights later, with the lights out, Rich plays the tape to discover a rare song from the 1920 Mississippi Delta, an artifact, a primitive transmission, a faraway crackle of hope in a voice shining in the dark. How does Robert find this stuff with all the convolutions, crap, and breakdowns, like when the baler leaked hydraulic fluid and the bearings whined like a wounded animal? Robert found the spare part at the bottom of a bucket of oily bolts, and the foreman huffed and puffed hot air, wasting everyone's time. Shame on you, Robert, for wandering into the mystery to find a new exotic fragrance, as if we can't smell this unholy stench in the here and now, or see the slip hazards of a nation lost in love with this stuff. One morning, early, I enter the warehouse. Robert stands alone on the threshold of synesthesia. He's singing like American Idol. His ecstatic voice shapes the air with colors, hands cupped around his ears, his smiling face turned toward the gray heaven seeping through dirty skylights. And I see the sound as substance in wavelength, skipping flagstone blue on the concrete floor, fracturing against the forklift in glass needles of violet and lavender, bouncing prismatic across the I-beams and disappearing purple into the metal roof, echoing the essence of indigo. On the first day of winter, he gives Isabel, the secretary, a paperback book with a cracked binding and torn cover, perhaps a few back pages missing. He says to her, "You read." The foreman scolds Robert for bringing trash into the front office. As they drift like debris toward the loading docks, Isabel stares at the tattered pages. She tries to understand how, after 30 years, she reads words inscribed in green ink on the title page. to my daughter Izzy on your birthday. Her mother's gift returning by unknown circuits from a journey, a strange trip, a migration home. Robert is always a messenger in the crosshairs, gathering castaways from odd pieces of metal, cracked wheels, bent pulleys from the garbage heap of the universe, to reassemble a steampunk machine designed to untangle the twisted braids of our trauma and our loss. And on my last day of work, a day of reckoning, he pushes through the no-entry door and gives me a pencil. He says, "You write." And before I can thank him, my inside boss, the crazy, bald man arguing with the cloud, says, "You don't belong here." And in a moment, the bodhisattva of salvage is gone, and with him the full spectrum of merciful frequencies, modulated to receive, tuning good for nothing into kindness, and immune to the consuming static of want, need, and the dollar almighty. So when a friend tells me of Robert's untimely passing, I spend hours looking for that pencil, hidden away, misplaced, borrowed, stolen, lost, and I feel the gray creep of weariness as I reach into the dark for comfort, returning instead with a small light, a few memories, and a bucket full of words for Robert.
That's stunning, John.
Thank you.
Thanks.
This one I wrote right after I saw the black and white author photo that my publisher took of me. This one's called Black and White and Dorian Gray. A photo is taken in black and white. You're forced to confront yourself in stark exposure, every furrow and hollow emerging deep and dark through the pixels. What you've been and thought and said, what you've done with all your time, displayed by implication, your hair gone white, the traceable lines. Is there not another face to take instead, my parade of sins and stumbling mistakes, and the indifferent cellular errors of time? Favorite emotions etched dark onto this pale face, as if by stylus onto tin, better thoughts and worse, recorded for you or against you, it's hard for even you to tell. Ambiguity always saves you, and forgetting. The mouth compresses against its story. Just before the camera clicks, opts for a rueful smile instead, drawing the viewer right into the questions you don't want to answer. Loath to give the account, the awkward account, of a life both good and not, that does not really add up to what you hoped and asked for from the years, what you intended and would now like to claim. But go ahead and tell your story anyway. You know you've lied before.
That's wonderful. Well, lots of people love their pussycats. So I'm going to read a two-part cat series here, a little short one about the old cat and a second one about the new cat. First part is called Please Touch. Kitty is growing old. His thick black fur, like the pelt of night, goes thin and brown, so when he basks now, he reminds me of the swatch of beaver fur at the Mountain Man show, labeled Please Touch. And that, in the sun, is all he asks. Mm-hmm. The second part is called Metamorphosis. Two new kittens saw me off to Texas. Only one ran out when I came home. Bentley was gone. His brother Bo, ears flat, stared east, terrified. Mm-hmm. I took him in, and when I went back out into the night, a gray shadow ran past the porch. Coyotes yipped nearby, sang beneath the morning moon all night long. Long is the litany of cats that went before. Milkweed, Brownie, Bridget, Virga, any number of nameless strays, all run off to join the coyotes. The highway is hard on cats and dogs and deer, but Coyote is the great leveler, agent of revenge for vole and shrew and thrush. Splitting wood today, I heard an odd sound from my near woods,
like puppies at a den. They were coyote pups playing in the sun on the bank, as Bentley had last week, playing and gnawing and growing as cat transmogrifies into dog.
Very good.
This is another from that glossary. Jumping up to G, grace. From Middle English by way of Old French and Latin. Gratia, pleasure, favor, thanks. Effortless beauty of form, performance. To give beauty or elegance to honor or favor, an unmerited gift from God, the thanks made for a meal, a given name. After horizons of only grays, she began to know again the way waves foam and spin around the ankles, the crab's so suitable symmetry, how the wings lift and glide a gull through air, the slap and crack as sails draw full, the long thin fingers of the man she married, their tantalizing touch, the comet's tail swept back like hair in the wind, cooler lips that kiss a fevered brow, the moon in the west at dawn, wind calm, her mother's name, the many forms of grace.
Beautiful. Very nice.
Beautiful, beautiful.
This is a poem called Mathematics. It's one that Rick particularly liked. I appreciated when we would have the open mics. Rick was very generous with his observations and praise to all of us.
Yes,
yes, he was.
And he really liked this one. This one actually is the poem that appeared in Analog. It's called Mathematics. I once understood the formulas, the mathematics of timing, the algorithms of risk, the calculus of forgiveness. Now, I'm not so sure. In my youth, I questioned the square root of sacrifice, the bleeding radical abundance nailed to the tree of algebraic marvels. Now, I wonder if I can spare some change. Then we relied on the multiplier, a token of kindness, seven times the reciprocal of grief, circulating like a lucky coin, the currency of children. Now my pockets are empty. If I open a book from my youth and discover a page of arithmetic homework, I wonder if I would recognize the penmanship, the confidence of the sevens, the passion of the nines, or the prime mystery of 11. Now and then, I seek proof in the missing pieces of this equation. Something less than the sum of all its broken parts. Across this gap of time, this spectrum of differentials, this range of all things being equal, I find myself on one side and you on the other.
Oh, very nice.
You were listening to Talking Earth. This is Patrick Bocard, your host, and we're here in the studio with Florence Sage, John Simonello, who you just heard, Jim Dott, and Bob Pyle, who are all poets involved in the Astoria poetry scene. And we're also here to remember the life of Rick Rana, who moved to Astoria from Portland and was important in both here and in the Astoria local scene. Did we want to read a poem of Rick's now, or...
Yes.
Florence, do should I read one? Or?
I think you should.
You should. Yes.
My question is what one should I read? Performance bio? The copy you gave me, that's not the entire poem, is it?
No, it's the end of the poem, though. And what I like about it is it's Rick writing about himself.
Okay, I'll read that then. The end of performance bio. Well, so there you have it. Just me, a regular guy, if there ever was one. A schmuck who manages to keep himself well-fed, and although he's periodically lost track of a few, usually stays in a job long enough to get sick of it. Fact is, I'm a smashing success, no kidding, with a couple of kids who actually like me, nobody hounding me for past due debts, a few bucks left over at the end of every month. I ain't dead yet, and I can still write a poem or two.
Wonderful.
Did Did anyone else want to read a poem of Rick's right now? Or?
Well, I'm not sure we have another one of Rick's, but we have Rick loved a good love poem. So well,
that would be
can
good.
We read a pair of a conversation of love poems in Rick's honor?
That sounds great.
Bob and I have a matching pair of poems. It was a challenge.
And they gave Rick a big smile when he heard
it. And, of course, there's a little exaggeration, but, you know, we're poets. Mine is called Au Toilette. She bolts for the bathroom as they come in, racing against gravity and internal force. Not so young anymore. Slides down her clothes, her pants to the floor, and in he barrels. Wait, you got ahead of me. Bracing his bulk against the sink and grab bar, he carefully kneels on the porcelain tiles, lands his lips on her thigh. Or more, the place where her thigh meets her torso. Pale, private, privileged, unsunned. Metal joints in there or not, he kisses the spot. Tender as his heart is, how can she say don't to this, his favorite little indoor game? No matter that she knows now, it'll take her a while to let go. Urgency transformed. Let them pause like this together, her hand soft on his silver head. Who'd imagine it outside this little room, this ardent septuagenarian tableau?
He kisses her as she pees, when he can catch her in the act, which might sound strange or even kinky, but when else does just that exposure of body occur against the enticing foil of clothes? Flank, hip, thigh, all in a soft L, held still for minutes at a time, and even she'll agree, never kissed enough. After sipping wine or tea, time always comes for a pause, a stretch, a pee. It happens. The girl sits, the boy kneels, and as her muscles relax, he kisses her in that pale, blue-veined, silky fold, that sweet declivity where leg and middle meet. And what could be the matter with that?
Yes, yes, yes.
I have to say, I read that at a writers' conference in Bellingham a few weeks ago, and there was a party afterwards at the bookseller's loft, and there was a couple there, and there was a woman. She was just grinning and grinning and grinning, and with her husband, and I said, "Hi, I'm Bob." You know, she said, "I know, I heard your poem." She said, "And we can't wait to get out of here."
We do these little challenges now and then and cool. See what we come up with.
Can't always be responsible for the effects of our poems on others.
No.
I'm going to go next with a poem from a series I've written on trees. This one's called Roots. Theirs is not the world of light. They go below, probe soil's night, branch, work around stones, fret at bedrock cracks, branch, drink and twine together, store the sap, branch, spread deeper, farther from the center. The seed, squirrels missed, always gravity's allure. Thick as torsos, then thighs, forearms, fingers, narrowing to net strands, fine as spider's silk, where root tip ends and soil begins, only an atom's breadth. Step carefully when they breach and twine the trail, resubmerge their world, brought to light only when wind thrown, undercut by roadwork, flooded up whole when the river crests. They are the anchor, they are the well, the way down that leads back, the river, the road to light.
Mm-hmm. I can't wait for your book of tree poems, Jim.
John.
In the vein of love poems, I have a series of poems that I wrote to my wife, Patricia, and this is the third of that series. It's called Three. On the trail above timberline, you untie the entangled winds of your intentions, and I become the penny whistle, singing melodies to the stars. By the stream pouring from the glacier, you calm the troubled currents of your uncertainty, and I dip my cup into the icy waters of the source. At the lakeside camp under a firmament, you remove the fear of departure and arrival, and I light three candles to the shrine of our beginning. Through a skylight of constellations, we watch the clockwork of the moon, And in the darkness outside the glow of our circle, the stone waits for a spark. An owl sails past a fir tree and swoops toward the alpine meadow. Fog moistens the joints of the timber, and the breath of the forest mystifies the night.
If I may jump in with a, well, this should be a love poem by Rick.
Good.
It's actually from a blown out Portland's Indie Poets, which is from a while ago.
Great.
Your bedroom in the dark. From within us, somewhere comes the yearning. Climb stairs like fish spawning to your apartment. Floorboards creak our presence to those below. Muffled clicking of our bones under muscle. Shoes, socks, underwear scattered like islands. Warm with recent bodies on a hardwood sea. A line I scratched out before sleep lies on a crumpled paper near the water glass. Your bedroom, red, even in the dark. Suddenly strange. Where is it? My place here. Hush, silence, child, or they'll find you.
Thank you.
So, Florence, did you want to start another? We have more than enough time for another round of poems, I believe.
Well, okay. Well, here is another kind of love poem. I kind of got Bob on this one. It's called, and this was just in the latest Rain magazine, along with Rick's poem that we read earlier, Ship Report. This is called Sneak, Sneaked, Snuck. Remember, poets exaggerate. He's trying to say his words just right as he slips into bed and paws her waist to wake her up, changing his mind about quiet after failing badly to sneak in. Clump, clump, bang, thud, switch the bathroom light on. Oh, shit, didn't mean to do that. Brushes his teeth, swish, swish, and spit. He's trying to conceal how much he's had to drink. Drink, drank, drunk. Hey, he can still conjugate the verb right in his head, so maybe he's not so badly wasted. Just a couple of beers, not mentioning they were pints, and a very small glass of wine, four fingers high. He'll show her if she asks, but don't mention the scotch to top it off. Do not mention that. He's trying to wrap his mouth precisely around his intentions. The vowels, that's where you hear the drunk, he thinks. So enunciate like hell. But whole syllables get left out he doesn't notice. And here his voice rises like a girl's and speeds way up, defying his floppy tongue. Defying his floppy tongue and drink sedated lips. And there's another sibilant gone bad. He almost hears it blurring and knows she's listening. Can you say like a hawk or an owl in the night she's listening? Nothing gets past her. He's doomed. But if she says he's tanked, he'll say, no, no, just half. But then he merrily blurts out, I'm glad you're not a state trooper. He thinks now probably she's got him pegged. And maybe he's got her crying as she's shaking a bit under his mitt. Until she bursts out with her merry laugh, and he cringes for the blow. And there, she says it, done. But it doesn't come out as bad as he thought, because what she said is, you're squiff tonight, my love. And it's the first time she said those words to him, my love, just plain like that. And that's when he falls asleep, snort and snore, beside her. Not to remember tonight in the morning, asleep content that something very welcome has snuck into his dreams.
Mm. Very, very nice.
Not too badly exaggerated.
No.
This sounds like it's going to be a love song, and in a way it is. It's in love with life. It's from my earlier book, Evolution of the Genus Iris, and the title of the poem is Going Down Again. As a man who sinks in water, I have never been gravity's friend in open air. I remember falling out of a locust tree at 10, stealing magpie eggs, off bicycles, of course, hard on tailbone in the Fox Aurora, tripped by a girl, and again on rock at Boreas Pass, from a ladder, raking my forearm raw on oaken bark. Stumbling over Logan curbstone, shaking the pavement with the force of my fall, and once almost over backwards under heavy pack on sharp pumice ridge in the Dark Divide. I never liked pratfalls in comedy. Feel physical pain before butt meets dirt, when it isn't even my butt. For this reason, I clamber, not climb up mountains. For this reason, I go slowly over broken ground. It is good that my bones are like those of Titanotheres, the way my body craves the earth. Yesterday, in Billy Meadows, my foot found a stick end on. Pole vault came to mind as I shot up, out, and down. Landed on cheek with crack, I took for bone, or lens at least. Lay there, taking stock, and then, daubing a little blood, stood and shook it off. Happy, happy to be back up one more time.
Yes.
Okay, this next one's a little bit longer than the previous one, so it's called Walking Elegy. It has a little epigraph by Rilke. We are grasped by what we cannot grasp. I go out walking beyond the gate at the end of the street. The early sun is gone, and now a light rain falls. I go walking neither toward nor away, not spinning in place, but out, unraveling the tangle, looking for what's come up, begun to flower, ripen. Sometimes off the path like Thoreau, through orchards, meadows, quick pace to sweat out the maladies of civilization, or slowly like Darwin round and round his sand walk to contemplate and coalesce his thoughts, earthworms, evolution. Or like Dickens treading miles and miles through his good old city, up lanes, down alleys, past shop fronts, picking up faces, names, striding out the story. It was the best of times. It was the worst of times. The siren keens, someone's dying, something's burning, everything is broken, everyone's in pain. Why are you just walking? Mm. Young blackberry canes, new spruce shoots, leafing alder crowd the trail. The salmon berries are plump, first a hint of sweetness, then the acid bite at the back of the tongue. Each new terror is repeated and replayed until the next arrives. After the explosion, the fire, the search, the rubble that was their home, that is their grave, the three-year-old beaten and drowned in a toilet. How can you turn your back and walk away? How can I stare and stay? I'll make each walk a pilgrimage, each step a prayer, find a garden to ramble through like Rilke at Duino Castle. Perhaps there is a paradise to reach before legs grow weary, weak, before all hope is tossed away. Rilke walked on the cliff path, would have peered down the white limestone walls to an eroded pillar, a veiled woman at the waterline of the bay below, the white lady of legend. Turned to stone to save her from the rocks her wrathful husband hurled her toward. Knights, some have seen her on the castle stairs, in the gardens, seeking her children. The reporter says the shooter scratched the name of each target in a cartridge, that each slug hit its intended, punctured flesh, shattered bone. I know for some the garden gate has been slammed shut, no one to come out to them, no hint, no hope, or even want of love, I know. Remember that drone that bombed a wedding party in Yemen, all killed? There were eyes peering at the screen, assumptions solidified, orders in the ear, a hand on the joystick. Who, if I cried out, would hear me? Who, if I did not, would notice or care? Would you condemn me like some have Rilke, his silence deemed denial, cowardice? Auden said Rilke refused to understand war, how it spills out until its stench soaks everything. To understand meant to accept its inevitability, if not necessity. To this, he said no. Wouldn't you kill to protect family, home, country, the goods you've built your comfort with? Wouldn't you keep it on hand as a deterrent, the ultimate option when all else fails? Have you been to war? Would you disrespect the sacrifice so many have made? No, no, and no, and no. Torments storm the gate, all those abandoned angels, the lover left alone in the garden, the white lady's husband drunk on rage, her cliff of screams echoing, echoing. So I go out walking, not away, not toward, but into, light rain, the morning dripping green.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
Stilling. Beautiful. Stilling.
My last poem is going to be called Everywhere. Where are you? And who are you? Are you a lotus eater dreaming away another afternoon watching TV? Are you an illusionist turning men into pigs? Or a giant with a patch on your eye, taunted until you blindly hurdle boulders the size of VW bugs into the sea? Or are you perhaps the tormentor-in-chief, safe inside a bottle, corked for another adventure, shouting back to needle the powers that be, I am nowhere and I am no one? Poised above the precipice above, do you wonder why survival depends on the perfect gesture of listening? When I am nowhere, I am everywhere, in the earthquake, in the mica of the granite, in the mutton of the lanolin of the fleece, in the grape and in the delirium of wine, in the sail and in the promise of the wind. When I am no one, I am a wanderer in search of signs, seeking clues in the clouds of mud beneath my boots, in the ripple of the seventh wave, and in the fiery belly of the stars. Thank you.
Dear John, you've been listening to Talking Earth. I've been here in the studio with John Simonello, who you just heard, Florence Sage, Jim Dott, and Bob Pyle. Do we have any last messages to our listenership out there about Rick or about Astoria? Anything anyone would like to say?
I want to thank you, Patrick, and Barbara LaMorticella and everyone else who's been involved with poetry at KBOO and in Portland. KBOO was really the mother station for KMUN, which is so much a part of our lives, and poetry tradition carries on at both stations. We feel it's important, and we thank you for having us and continuing to give poetry and the literature, the land, a place on the radio.
Mm-hmm. If you want to come down, it's our reading is at the Winecraft, which is on Pier 11 in Astoria, and it's on the first Tuesday of every month.
It
starts at sign up at 6:45, and reading starts at 7.
And called Rick's Poetry Mike, as a thanks to Rick,
Rana. Portland person who wants to come down and see the river
and celebrate Rick Vrata.
Yeah, exactly. Yes,
exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And read some poetry. The sea lion singing
and hear
behind
some.
Us.
Yes. Well, that's right. I'd like to thank you all listening out there. This has been Talking Earth. Please stay tuned for the next show.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the Montevilla Jazz Festival taking place August 20th and 21st at Portland Metro Arts in Portland. The Montevilla Jazz Festival focuses on Portland's originally composed progressive jazz scene and will feature Jeff Baker, The In-Betweens, the Jessica Smith Big Band, Batita Differente, and many more, including a full lineup on the student stage. Again, that's the Montevilla Jazz Festival taking place August 20th and 21st at Portland Metro Arts, 9003 Southeast Stark Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right-hand side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor Extreme Amateur Games BMX Competition. Round 2, Sunday, August 28th at D Block Indoor Skate Park in Clackamas. This is round 2 in the Mad Bro Extreme Amateur Games. Winners are allowed to compete in the following competitions and in the final. Again, that's Extreme Amateur Games BMX Competition round 2, Sunday, August 28th at D Block Indoor Skate Park, 8921 Southeast Jansen Road in Clackamas. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.